If it's too dark, let me know and I can adjust.
Planning Commission work session, March 2.
I get everyone's assistance. So I think everyone has met Mr. Swindell. He's our new planning commissioner. Welcome. Today we'll be going through the work session on the concurrency code update. And then we're scheduled for a public hearing on March 16th in 2 weeks. A little bit about this presentation. I'm going to give a broad overview of what concurrency is, why we use it, its importance to us. And then David Jardine, who's in Public Works and is the concurrency manager, will actually go through the details of why this code language is necessary and our recommendation. So concurrency is one of the goals of the Growth Management Act. Its intention is to have adequate facilities in place or strategies in place at the time that new development occurs. To maintain concurrency is to have facilities in place while that new development actually receives the building permit. Those facilities, typically in transportation, are there and the development can proceed without occurring on substandard facilities. In particular, the growth management specifically defines concurrent with development as improvements or strategies in place at the time of development or that a financial commitment is in place to complete the improvements or strategies within 6 years. And 6 years is kind of important because that's what our transportation improvement program is built off. Those are projects that are in the pipe, have dedicated funding, and are ready to be built in the 6 years. The county uses our concurrency code in basically two different formats. One, when development comes forward, and David will talk about that. And then the other is in formulating our capital facilities plan. For you guys that were around a year ago, you'll remember I gave kind of a presentation on the basics of the capital facilities program. And our concurrency code has certain thresholds in it. When a facility is failing, when it's needed to be improved. We use that as basically our performance measure to determine what projects get put on the CFP. It's our way of saying this project, this road is needed in improvement to facilitate new growth, and it's needed as part of our 20-year capital facilities plan to facilitate it. This code has a brief history. Back in 2016 in August, there was an emergency ordinance that was passed by the board with this code. They went on in October 25th and made that emergency ordinance an interim ordinance, extending it for 6 months for us to take this code, vet it, take it through the public process, and to refine it in order to make it permanent. So we met earlier with DEEB today, and that's the Development Engineering Advisory Board, and they recommended a unanimous approval. So with that, I'll hand it over to David Jardine, and he'll go through the problem that we're trying to solve.
So as you're walking away, and I'll ask a question. Does the GMA establish what we use for concurrency, or does it give the county the opportunity to establish it for itself?
It gives the local jurisdictions the discretion to define what concurrency measures.
Good evening. I'm David Jardine, concurrency engineer for Public Works. I work with development engineering. I look at current development, traffic study review, and I do the review and evaluation staff reports for new developments that want to come in. I take a look to make sure that their developments, transportation impacts can be accommodated on the adjacent road network. Or I'm the guy that they hate a lot because it cannot be accommodated on the local or the surrounding road network, and I ask them to do mitigation, lane adds, lane widening, signals. They don't like me too much when I do that. But so a little bit of concurrency code history. Prior to August 2010, the concurrency code was written so that the development that triggers a concurrency-related mitigation had to volunteer to build or wait for the county to build all mitigation necessary to comply with the county's mobility standards. Subsequent development that impacted that same transportation facility and failure under that code would need to volunteer to ensure the construction of the concurrency-related mitigation or wait until the infrastructure was constructed. All a development would have to do is send one trip to the failing facility to be conditioned with mitigation or requested to volunteer the mitigation. That subsequent development could be as small as a 2 or 3 lot short lot. It just depends on where their primary access and, or the primary road to get into and out of their site was. The result of the concurrency code language, large developments could trigger mitigation and then wait out subsequent development for those projects to build the improvements in front of them. And then for and/or small developments were requested to volunteer very large concurrency related mitigations. So in August 2010, the Board of County Commissioners at that time approved some code language that was put in place to provide opportunity for smaller developments to occur without being tagged with substantial mitigations that were generated by bigger development in the area. So the bolded underlined language got added as a result of that BOCC action. I'll just read it. However, proposed developments shall not be required to mitigate their impacts in order to obtain concurrency approval unless the proposed development adds at least 5 peak period trips to a failing intersection approach. The projected volume to capacity ratio for the worst lane movement on the approach with the highest delay exceeds 9/10 during the peak traffic period, and that same movement is worsened by the proposed development. So the result of that code language, small developments that one or two lot short plats could apply these new code exemptions or thresholds to determine if their traffic impacts would be subject to mitigations for failing intersections. Small developments were able to be constructed without having to volunteer substantial concurrency-related mitigations. Trips generated by the small developments would still be accounted for in traffic studies. Basically, what that ended up being is a background traffic growth rate of 2% per year that would capture all of these the trips generated by small development in the area. The the developments that would generate between one and, say, nine trips. If they generated 10 peak trips, then they generate a traffic study, and I get to review them under the entire concurrency ordinance. Since the 2010 code language was put in place, there have been no small development cases that have used these exemptions to move forward. We had a small development that actually was kind of the impetus of this code change that went to pre-app, but never a formal land use application. Because once they heard, and this was before the code change, once they heard what kind of mitigation was necessary, they put the brakes on that project. It was a 10-lot subdivision with nine new PM peak hour trips. In any other case, that would have only required them to submit a traffic profile, and then they were done. But in that particular case, one of the intersections that was there, one of their primary ingress egress routes was a failing intersection, and that at the time happened to be 119th Street, 50th Avenue. At that time, it was a four-way stop. So, some unintended consequences. I have an example here for you. Large development's use of the concurrency exemptions to justify compliance with the concurrency code. So, an unsignalized intersection impacted Northeast 88th Street and 94th Avenue. We just did a very big capital improvement project on 94th between Patton and 105th to the north. 88th Street is like the first major intersection we've come to on that new three-lane cross-section of 94th. 88th Street is stop control. The proposed development total PM peak hour trip generation, 281. And 165 of those 281 peak hour trips entered the intersection approach of 88th and 94th. Traffic study findings, out of the 165 peak hour trips that entered the intersection of 88th and 94th, five PM peak hour trips were added to the eastbound stop controlled approach. It was determined a level of service F on the stop control approach. And the volume to capacity on that approach was 0.62. So now applying the threshold portion of the unsignalized concurrency ordinance, does the proposed development add five peak hour trips to the failing approach? The answer to that is yes. Is the projected volume to capacity for the worst lane movement on the approach with the highest delay equal to or greater than 0.9? The answer to that is no. The worst lane movement on the approach with the highest delay made worse by the proposed development? The answer to that is yes. The eastbound to northbound left turn movement delay is increased by 10 seconds, according to their traffic study. So after the evaluation against the exemption threshold, or the thresholds of the unsignalized intersections, no mitigation is required because only two of the three exemptions were met. So as a part of any of my reviews, even though it may not meet or require concurrency mitigation, safety is always reviewed for each individual intersection. Not only by do I require it in traffic studies, but if there's any question, I do an independent evaluation and I pull my own crash records to look at the safety of the intersection. So although no mitigation was required under the county concurrency code, the crash evaluation is performed. Staff's review found that only one documented crash in the most recent 5 years, and that equated to a crash rate of a 0.09 crashes per million entering vehicles. So the threshold for more evaluation by one of our reference manuals that we use, the ITE, or the Institute of Transportation Engineers Traffic Access and Impact Studies for Site Development, says that any intersection with more than one accident per million entering vehicles is worthy of additional analysis. And that's where that one crash per million entering vehicles threshold comes from, where I require more evaluation from the applicant's engineer. But because the crash rate was 0.09 crashes per million entering vehicles, no further analysis is required. So the issue, the current exemption language indicates that all three exemptions need to be met before mitigation can be required. The projected volume to capacity ratio of 0.9 is very difficult to achieve at an intersection if not all approaches are stop controlled. Because the volume to capacity ratio of 0.9 is difficult to achieve, there may be some missed opportunities to require development to mitigate the impacts of their development. Sorry, I'm crazy there. So I've got a couple of examples here to try and show how difficult it is to achieve a volume to capacity of a 0.9. So volume to capacity. In an intersection, just the geometry, the number of lanes or the lane configuration has a capacity associated with it. So on approach, these lanes could have a capacity of 1,000 vehicles per hour. So the way the volume is counted is that's actual volumes. How many cars can you get over this point right here in an hour? And you take that volume, divide it by the capacity on that roadway, that lane, and you come up with a volume to capacity. So if you notice up here, there are many cars that are queued waiting to come out from that stop sign, either across the road or onto the main line, which is this road here. Again, you use the capacity just for example purposes, 1,000 vehicles for this lane in an hour, and everyone that crosses past that stop sign and through that intersection is counted once. So what you could have is a stack of cars like that, a level of service F, but because you can't get those cars across the street or out onto the main line, you have a very low volume. So out of 1,000, maybe 10 cars in an hour can get out there because there's so much mainline volume here. So your volume to capacity is very low. It's nowhere near a 0.9, even though you sit in traffic for half an hour trying to get through that stop sign. So for entertainment value, this is a simulation model, and there are as I've run this in the past, there have been many close calls. So, to try and give you an example of what's going on here. So, on the main line, or the uncontrolled portion of this intersection, all these cars that are going zipping by and making turning movements, level of service A, almost no delay at all. They can, when they get a gap, they can cross the street or turn or whatever. On the side street, stop control, you see many cars stacking up because of the volume on that main line. The cars are too close, they're not going to shoot a gap and try not to cause accidents that way. So they sit. So the volume over the capacity will be quite low here. So this intersection on this far side over here, I'd say a volume to capacity 0.5, but level of service F with that kind of queuing issue that was shown there. So volume to capacity on an always stopped intersection is a little, you can see it a little bit better because all vehicles stop and give the right of way to another vehicle, so everybody can get through that intersection. So you're stuffing more cars into that intersection than what you could get with two lanes that were under control. So you could see a volume to capacity increase. Hopefully it didn't die. Please don't die. So now we're stuffing cars through that intersection, and everybody has an opportunity to go. It's no two lanes are favored over the other two. So, as a result of what we were finding, we reached out to, I've been talking with traffic engineers, not in a formal meeting kind of setting like this, but just as we've run across being able to talk. So many traffic engineers in the area, many that have done many traffic studies in this area, and talk to them about this language change, this interim ordinance that's been put into place, basically striking this number two with the volume to capacity language, to kind of get a feel for, do they understand why I'm trying to get rid of that number two threshold? Or is it going to cause them a bunch of heartburn? And kind of the overall message is, when we called to talk to you before about do you really mean volume to capacity of a 0.9 at this intersection that we're studying, we've been calling to inquire about that because we realize that the level of service is so poor out here and you'll never achieve that 0.9. that we'll never have to mitigate. So we wanted to call and just make sure that that your code says what you wanted to say. So we also talked with WashDOT a little bit about the code change, and they've actually suggested some code, some language, and it's up here. The strikeout is the signalization. The add is intersection control or mitigation of unsignalized intersections. Basically, what that does is that we do have some state routes that are governed by the concurrency ordinance, and at those locations, it may not be signalization. It may be roundabouts, it may be lane adds, it may be whatever the mitigation is. So in more of kind of a general sense, intersection control or mitigation made more sense, and that just kind of made more opportunity for different types of mitigations or intersection controls that could be put into place there. And then the ultimate language change here that we're trying to get to is striking the volume to capacity language outright and leaving the five trips to the failing intersection approach, and the worst movement on the failing approach is worse than the proposed development. What that does, it maintains what we were trying to achieve in the first place, and that's watching out for the smaller developments that may have less than 10 peak hour trips sending trips to a failing intersection, and So basically helping the moms and pops do their developments without being tagged with huge mitigations. But it also catches those developments that are large enough to send these 5 or 6 peak hour trips to a failing intersection approach, and all it would take on the worst movement on the failing approach is to maybe add one vehicle to that failing movement, or the worst movement on that failing approach. So in a lot of cases, the larger developments may be able to use something like this on the outer ends of their study spectrum. But close in, it helps to protect the smaller developments from some very large concurrency-related mitigations.
Before you go on, forgive me, but I don't clearly understand, what's the standard? Is the standard level of service E?
That is correct. The standard for unsignalized intersections, you can have a level of service E at a concurrency regulated intersection if you do not meet signal warrants. If you meet signal warrants, then you fail the intersection, or the intersection is failing. And you may need to volunteer mitigation as a developer.
So what does a level of service E mean then in relationship to peak hours?
Level of service has to do with delay times.
Yeah.
And so in peak hour periods, you could experience some very long wait times. It would be like the two-way stop controlled approach. So you may be waiting for 30 seconds to get out onto the main line and go. If there's enough volume to where you, on the main line, that you can't get out for longer than that, you may be at a level of service F and signal warrants may be met. So the installation of a signal or some other kind of control that would allow the side streets to get out into traffic without having to make some dangerous movements. See, I got to make sure that I'm going to get back to the original question here. And the original question is, what is level of service E in relation to a peak hour period?
Hey, Ron, when we were going to school, you couldn't get an E. Once you went world E, you got an F.
Well, that will be my follow-up question for number 3. When it says on the failing approach, I'm assuming then that means you're dealing with a level of service of F to call it failing?
Yes.
So E is not failing.
Right.
The new math. Okay.
Right. Yeah, so if you're a level of service E and you meet signal warrants, that would be determined by your traffic engineer. And that would be based on volume, based on delay, based on crash history, and a couple other items I can't remember off the top of my head. You could meet signal warrants and still be a level of service E. If that was the case, then the intersection or the approach would be failing, or a level of service F.
Due to meeting signal warrants.
Due to meeting signal warrants.
Okay. Although in the next portion we say, if warrants are met, unsignalized intersections of regional significance shall achieve level of service D.
That's correct. So at a level of service D, you may still experience long delay times, but for I guess the example would be stop-controlled side streets, a main line that has a signal just down the street here. So for a 30-second period, you have a bunch of cars coming through you there and you can't get into the intersection. But after those cars pass, now you can get out there. Level of service D. So that operational standard, even though signal warrants may be met, there's more evaluation that would need to go into why you would need a signal at that location. Because you wouldn't want to place any controls that that really weren't necessary.
Okay, so it's a little confusing for me when we say the warrants are met, but it's still an unsignalized intersection. That says the warrants are met, but we don't have an intention of signalizing, or the warrants are met and it's on a plan to signalize as a result of the warrants being met?
If the warrants are met, the developer would need to would either need to propose installation of a signal or a mitigation that would offset the impacts of their development in that intersection to bring it back to a pre-developed there prior to their development being there.
So they have to bring it to a D or better to get out of the responsibility of putting a signal in?
Not necessarily.
No. Not necessarily.
So it's basically what we're after is we're after the developer to mitigate the impacts of their development on our roadway. So we start out with, if you're a level of service E, you may need to do a signal warrant analysis to find out if you meet signal warrants. If you do meet signal warrants, the county would accept a proposal of some type of countermeasure to be installed by your development to offset the impacts of your development on that intersection. So basically what we're after is we're after adding capacity back into that intersection or approach that would offset the impacts of your development. So what that could mean is instead of a signal, you meet signal warrants, but instead of having to install a signal, what your traffic engineer is able to show is that you could build back the capacity that your development took by adding a lane, a dedicated right turn lane or a dedicated left turn lane, or what else could they do? Some other type of traffic control, maybe a roundabout, maybe it's some place where they had a lot of control and they could propose a roundabout instead of a signal. As long as it was offsetting the impacts of that particular development in that intersection, the county would entertain it. And it doesn't have to be a signal.
Forgive me then. So if warrants are met, they need to propose some form of mitigation that eventually relieves the warrants from being met, which a roundabout would do that?
It's possible, yeah, absolutely.
But, okay, yeah. I'm trying to work with just a bit of certainty here with some standards, and it sounds like we're kind of fuzzy. So, a proposed development comes in, they're going to add some trips to an intersection that's already had the warrants met.
Yes.
And so to me it sounds like with the warrants being met it should automatically already be in line for proposed signal. It was already in line because the warrants were met before the development.
So as traffic grows in an area, traffic can grow to a point to where before the development signal warrant, and of no fault of anybody else's development that contributed to
right,
the area.
Right.
A development now comes in and they find out that an existing condition has a signal warrant.
But we're going to say that then there's some method that they can do so they can get out from underneath the obligation and the need for a signal will still remain.
That is correct.
Okay.
David, I have a question.
I'm done.
On the third point, the wording bothers me. Would it make more sense to say, on a failing approach, the worst movement is worsened by the proposed development? Because you don't know you have a failing approach.
No. How well could legal
level of service effort ready?
Would how well could a lawyer defend that wording in, the, in clause three?
The worst would be the proposed development.
I heard he wasn't failing.
That's the point. Is there necessarily a failing approach in all of these?
No, not necessarily. So
where you do have a failing approach, then that's necessary.
That's correct. So where we do have a failing approach, then that's where we're looking at, are they adding the five trips to that leg? Do the trips in that leg go to the worst movement on that approach?
So where's the previous reference to a failing approach?
The proposed development has at least five trips to a failing approach. Yeah, sorry, it got flattened.
David, what a failing intersection approach. Some of us were having a small discussion about this before the work session started. Does that mean a level of service F failing?
Yes.
Okay. So it is something that is in failure, not something that is approaching being in failure.
That is correct, yes. Level of service F, it is in failure.
Okay, thanks. And Robin, I know you asked me a question, but they were talking and we have a tape recorder on, so we have to do it one at a time.
Yeah. The question I had is, when I look at clause 3, it just seems to open a Pandora's box for conjecture between, say, developers' attorneys and county's attorneys, and how easy is it to defend from the county's position on, you know, what does worse mean, what does failing approach mean, what is worse?
It's subjective.
Yeah.
Is it subjective, or if a failing approach means level of service F, that's not subjective. Oh, yeah. And what David said was the worst movement on that approach, so say the left turn from, you know, the south approach or whatever.
And it's in conjunction with one.
So.
Right, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, and then is worsened means it adds one trip.
That's correct, yeah. So how
do we know those things to be the case? Are they defined in the code?
Worsen is not defined in the code, but it can be determined in what I use, is I use the delay that's in the traffic study that shows before and after.
Not
so
both and can't require you to mitigate. It's
using the example of 88th Street and 94th Avenue, we have a development that is just north of Patton, so it's just south of 88th Street. So as a part of that development, they're sending five trips on 88th to stop at the stop sign at 88th and 94th. The failing movement in that approach is the eastbound to northbound left turn. Okay, but because these trips are generated by the development on the south, all of those five trips are turning south to get to the development. None of them are in the failing movement, or the worst movement on the failing approach. So they may be able to get out of mitigation.
Because they haven't worsened it.
They haven't worsened it. So what I'm looking for there is first looking at the worst movement on the failing approach, are they contributing to that? If the answer is no, then we have to look at something else. Is there a crash history to support some kind of countermeasure or something there? Some other things that I'm sure I can't think of right now, but or are they sending one trip to the worst movement on the failing approach, which is that eastbound to northbound left turn? And then if the answer is yes, then you look at the delay in that on that movement. So the delay for the worst approach on that one, I don't remember if I said that or not. So just for example's sake, I guess, the delay on that eastbound to northbound left turn could be 80 seconds. And adding one trip into that movement now takes it from a delay of 80 seconds to 83 seconds. You've worsened the movement. So mitigation may be required.
David, that same case, if that intersection is signalized in that left turn movement, even with the added vehicle or two, if it completely flushes, then they'd be exempt. I mean, they technically would not have worsened it, right?
Correct. So there, for signalized intersections, there are totally different thresholds that we look at when we're evaluating those. And they're, because they look at the potential for the intersection being totally built out because of that signal, kind of as big as it can get, that the thresholds for a signal failure or mitigation at a signal are, the thresholds are large and it would take quite a bit to meet them.
The word worsened on number three criteria bothers me. It's subjective, not objective. And I don't understand what the criteria is. Is it adding 3 seconds to the 30 second at peak traffic hours? Or is it one more accident every 6 months? I mean, it's kind of you're using a word that doesn't have any criteria in my mind.
Sure.
To make it a positive statement.
Okay. And unfortunately with crashes, that what we have is documented crash history. That's what we use in our evaluation. But to project whether or not you're going to get more crashes is a little more difficult. That, in my opinion, would be very subjective. It would be more to clarify or define what worsen is, and that could be the worst movement on the failing approach.
By definition, you should be able to categorize that.
Has the delay on the worst movement on the failing approach is worse than by the proposed development.
So this is not a safety issue at all in this statement.
No. The safety evaluation is something that occurs whether or not we look at this or they meet these standards or not. The crash history is always evaluated. So maybe it's maybe adding a word in there that defines what's looked at to be what's worsened.
Like factors that might be considered or
that's
something
correct.
Like that.
Like the delay of the worst failing approach is worsened by the proposed development. Yeah. That way it gives somebody something to look at when they're looking at how did you arrive at what's worsened at that point.
So if the current time to get through was say 50 seconds, one trip makes it 55, we've altered the status quo.
Yes.
So really, if there's any impact from a development that alters the status quo,
yes,
you are tripping. Well, would that be a way of saying it? Mm-hmm. So that if the worst movement on the failing approach alters the status quo as a result of proposed development?
That is definitely a possibility. There are some approaches that are single lane approaches, stop controlled, where they may be just wide enough to get side by side right at the stop sign. So what you have is now a impromptu dedicated right hand turn lane that's being starved out by this left, the guy that's taking up all of that lane, and now nobody can get to the right. So, you know, maybe that adding that one trip to that failing approach, when you look at the delay has gone through the roof because nobody can get to that right turn lane.
I suppose where I'm coming from is I sort of tend to throw things in buckets, and I see you try and get something broad and encompassing. It's almost like the single lane where there's no way for anyone to get past or parallel to have two cars sitting at the intersection. Then there's the situation where you have two cars sitting parallel to the section, and then there's perhaps another one, and it's sort of almost like for this scenario we do X, for this scenario we do Y, for this.
I see where you're going with that.
Yeah, but as I can see where you're going from it as well too. But one of the things I think with transport is to it's a lot of sort of tossing things out there and saying on this case it could do this. Like you can have a development on the south side, assuming everyone's going up to the intersection. It turns out depends where those people are going to work or what's around, and they could do the complete opposite to what you think. Therefore, people are left with, well, that was bloody stupid. That development went through, and we haven't got any improvements to that intersection.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And we've experienced that recently.
Yeah.
There have been many developments here in the recent past that have. That we may have lost some opportunities for mitigations, and that volume to capacity for unsignalized intersections. After we saw what the unintended consequences were, we really tried to hurry up and try and figure out a way to still take into account the smaller developments and. Versus large mitigations, but still keep it such that the larger developments with big trip generators couldn't skate like they could before. So I don't know the answer and how to make this work with what you were describing, and I totally understand narrow lane approaches. That's just difficult all the way around, and I don't know of too many in the urban area, and they're more kind of rural in nature, those very narrow approaches. But I'm thinking more along the lines of in an urban setting, this is going to have a little bit more impact.
I think it's pretty clear that we need to work on the wording of number three before it goes to public hearing. So we can do that in the next week or two and get back to you before the public hearing with the revised staff report. So that it's more clear as far as what failure is.
If you do that, can you send the revised wording back to Deeb and get their...
Yeah, absolutely.
Before it comes to us, hopefully.
Yeah.
So before we leave this, Matt, though, I think I need to just... I'm going to try and paraphrase this in a fashion that makes sense to me. So the county is okay with level of service E and unsignalized intersections as long as the warrants aren't met. If the warrants are met, they really prefer the level of service to be D. But if there's a proposed development, then if they add 5 peak period trips to a failing intersection, therefore that tells me it has to be level of service F, and the worst movement on the failing level of service F intersection approach is worsened by that, then they're on the hook for something. But the public works director doesn't obligate the county to meet any better standards for the E or D intersections with that criteria. It's only when we're getting 5 peak, but it's level of service F. Is that correct? And they have to meet both criteria,
right?
Not just one.
Sweet. Okay. Yeah, I can't give you an answer as far as why those standards are set the way they are for one, but it's not consistent.
Part of my problem, I think, going forward is we don't appear to actually have a standard. We don't say that the county's standard is a level of service, say, C, and anything below that we would want to put out the opportunity that whatever happens to it next, we're going to improve it, signalize it, or whatever the case. If we continue to allow it to degrade as an acceptable practice until we get to F, then basically the next development that gets 5 peak period is undoubtedly going to add something to the worst movement. And I believe we'll end up just having people try and avoid the intersections that are at F.
But when you rate an intersection, is that an average of all the movements? So is it possible we could have a level of service C with one F approach?
I have looked at them that way before, and you get into trouble if you look at the average of the entire intersection because of that one failing approach. You lose out on some mitigations there too, or it could potentially end up in some kind of safety issue because people are having to wait such a long time to get off of that side street. So looking at the individual approaches kind of gives you a little bit better feel for where your problems may lie and then possibly what mitigations development, if contributing to that failing or that intersect or that approach in trouble may need to do. So and I apologize, I don't know everybody's name here, but I see where you're going with, you know, trying to be proactive in the level of service or maintaining a higher level of service. But if you get that level of service too high, for and you establish it at that point, and then everything below that, people have to start doing large amounts of analyses and possible mitigations to get it back to that level of C. That level of service C could be very expensive to achieve.
Okay, call it E. I'm not saying where it should be set. What I guess I'm saying, though, it has the appearance right now that even though those thresholds of D or E may be met, it says public works director shall not be obligated to maintain that. So we're going to say that, in essence, we're going to allow them all to potentially go to F, and then at that point we trigger 1 and 3. And I guess I'm just kind of looking for some understanding if that's the intention.
You know, that's not the intention of this particular amendment proposal.
Perhaps.
I think the intention of this amendment proposal is to remove from the exemption criteria a threshold that no development ever met. And as a consequence, every development was eligible for the exemption. That is what this is for.
I understand we're here to do a minor amendment, but I think the reality of it is what got us into this component is we have in our code the methodology for sliding to F, whether we gave exemptions or not, because it says the public works director is not obligated to do anything about if it slides from D to E or D to F.
It does.
Yeah.
David, let me ask the question again, because I think I can answer what Ron is asking. I think you can have an intersection that's not failing. It has a level of service C, D, or E. But in this context, it can have a failed approach.
Yes.
Okay, so we're not letting all these intersections degrade the day out. We're talking about one failing approach,
right,
on an intersection that otherwise is not failing, and dealing with that.
That's correct. And I apologize if I didn't understand what you were trying to get across. But yes, that is absolutely right. So in the examples that were shown, the two-way stop controlled with the main line that was uncontrolled, if you averaged that intersection, that's level of service B. If you looked at the side streets or one of the side streets, that's a level of service F. That's the one we're trying to mitigate. We're not trying to mitigate the entire intersection.
Oh, I get that. I do. Yeah. But moving in and out between the urban, unincorporated, out to the rural, I see those pathways degrading.
Oh, they are.
Right.
Definitely.
And we just added more with Alternative 2 to the rural land, so we're going to be impacting them to a greater degree. And I just think everybody should understand what the norm is. What's our standard? And if our standard is, we feel like under these circumstances they can go to F, we should be able to say that. And that's just a certainty then. Unless some large development comes through and needs to prop it back up. Okay.
I understand that. There's no question a lot of intersections are degrading.
Yeah.
But it usually starts one movement at a time.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, certainly.
It's like my knee, you know, it's like hell, but the other
Yeah, right. But it's not at an F yet. Yeah. All right, so thank you, and I appreciate you indulging me on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And thanks for pointing out that. So I think, yeah, you have valid. So,
we
keep going?
Go ahead.
All right, so this is, I kind of went over this before. This is what happened back in 2016 with the emergency and then the interim ordinance. The work plan that the interim ordinance defined for us was to go forward with the public comment as well as a recommendation from DEEB, yourselves, and then onto the BOCC adoption. This wasn't the next steps, but I think we have to add some more. We need to work on the third one, which is now the second. The worst movement on the failing approach is worsened by the proposed development, make that a little bit more clear. As well as address, is level of service F our actual level of service, or can we strengthen that? I understand that it can be subjective as far as when the public works director's opinion comes into place versus what our actual standard is.
And to me, it was just that one wording about failing for both one and three.
Yeah.
If failing is truly level of service F, I think we should just say it.
Say it.
Yeah.
So we'll meet. The DEEB already had their recommendation. Should the language change, we'll send that back out. And then move forward. The SEPA has been published. The comment period is right now. We'll relay those comments to you. The letter from WashDOT that David alluded to earlier is in your packet. That's on tab 6, I believe.
Yeah.
I'm glad you didn't make the other change WashDOT requested, which just
yeah.
gave them the discretion to make the decision.
Yeah, I didn't say that.
I think we need to keep that decision at the county level, not let the state decide our intersections for us. So I was glad to see that you didn't make that change.
A bit overreaching.
Yeah, I agree.
We coordinate with them. We took their letter.
You made their other change, so they should be happy.
We can put a roundabout on the 502. Change out some intersection.
Okay. You'll hear from us in the interim.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks,
David.
Thank you.
All right. I think that's it for our agenda tonight. Is there anything else? Look, I don't think so. No. All right. We are adjourned. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.